You're listening to the Forest School Podcast. Delicious waffle chat about education, nature connection, child development, community building, and lots more. Hosted by Lewis Ames and Wem Sutherland.
Hello, listeners. We're very excited. I'm very excited too.
I will put.
You put your hat in the ring there for excitement stakes. To have Lucy Jones with us. Lucy, we've met before, haven't we, at the Forest School Conference when you were a keynote speaker.
I think 3 years ago. It was at Danbury, wasn't it? So it wasn't.
Yeah.
But it wasn't last year. It was the year before.
Yeah.
So I think two.
2 years ago then. Yes. And since then, you have written the book Matrescence, all about becoming a mother, pregnancy, childbirth and motherhood, which we've both read and immediately were like, we really want to speak to Lucy again. It is without being too like sucky uppy, but like that's the point of podcasts, isn't it? When you have authors on, it's like you ask them because you really like the books and you really want to speak to them. But Matrescence has been one of those books where I've just read it and just instantly recommended it to everybody I know. Just like, I'm reading this book. You should read it. I actually listened to the audiobook, which you narrate, don't you? Which, yeah, so it kept me company on lots of long drives and it was just phenomenal. So thank you so much for joining us to talk about it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. That's so kind and really lush to hear.
Oh, it was amazing. It is amazing. Can you tell us a little bit, just to kick things off, about the journey with this book? Was it something that kind of sparked within you when you first became a mother, or when you had your third child, or somewhere in between, or was it even before then? Was there a kind of inkling there before?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, particularly the idea about an inkling before. I think my pregnancy with my first child was in kind of 2015, 2016. And I think I had a growing sense through my experience of pregnancy and then in birth and then in the metamorphosis of becoming a mother and being a parent, that the kind of bigness of the experience was like in such sharp contrast to like the smallness, I'm not going to get this right grammatically, but that how small it was depicted in culture and literature. And like in my literature degree, which is a long time now, I don't think I read one text from like a maternal point of view, or like zero scenes of birth. Anyway, so I felt that I'd kind of gone through life really knowing so little about birth, in our shared natality, what it takes to raise a child, the existential experience of becoming a parent, how psychological it is, how emotional it is, how physical it is, how social it is. And so immediately as a writer, I was really like kind of shocked, I think, by this like clash that I felt of how dramatic and cosmic and like seismic it felt to me, but how it felt like my culture, my society was just saying like, get on with it, it's not a big deal, like, you know, 6 week check, back to normal, 9 months in, back to work, you know, don't talk about your kids, don't, you know, keep it all kind of hush hush. It kind of blindsided me. So yeah, I guess, you know, that I started to think I want to explore this and understand it. And I, you know, as a writer, I try and understand things through writing them. So yeah, I think, and then in the drama of birth, that was a really big, huge existential experience for me, in so many ways. And I think at that point I thought, I'm going to have to write about this. And then I did write an essay about my so I'm going on a bit now, but I wrote an essay about my first birth for a really small, like, literary journal. It was for a friend was running it, and so I felt quite safe in writing really personally and quite openly, quite graphically. And the response to that, which was about 7 years ago, was like nothing I'd really written before. It felt like so many people, you know, men, women, were getting in touch, and it kind of gave me the confidence to create a book proposal and to want to explore it and actually write a book about it.
Yeah. Going back to what you said about sort of cultural presentations of motherhood and childbirth and things, that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because you do say that in the book. And, you know, at least in Europe, beyond the kind of thousands of depictions of like the Madonna and child, which is just like such a thing, isn't it? Apart from that, there, you're absolutely right, there's so few depictions of what it's like to be pregnant, what it's like to give birth. You know, you mentioned even like in music, you know, why aren't there billions of songs about love and all the rest of it, and nothing about having children? It's a very rare kind of topic. And I wondered if through your kind of research and your writing, you came upon any theories for why that might be, or had any thoughts about yourself, why there is this like weird, gigantic, missing lot of stuff culturally.
This episode of the Forest School podcast is brought to you again by the fantastic Forest Tawi stove. It's available from the guys over at carbonfarmers.world. This is honestly the ultimate tool for like setting up fires with an outdoor education group of any kind. So it's got three different cooking surfaces, it's smoke-free, and also allows you to get like the most out of your fire so that you can be as efficient as possible. The Forest Tawi stove, you can demonstrate the whole carbon cycle because you turn the organic material of the sticks into charcoal. You can make charcoal crayons. You can put the charcoal into like your compost bin and stuff and get rid of all the odors. Plus, it makes biochar as you're working. So I was reading this on their website. If you make a kilo of biochar, you have saved 3 kilos of carbon from going into the atmosphere. So the Forest Tawi is a carbon neutral stove, which is amazing. If one of your focuses with your outdoor groups is teaching about climate change or about sustainability, then you can literally demonstrate capturing carbon and keeping it from going into the atmosphere with this stove every time you have a fire. The Forest Tawi stove is honestly a must have for anybody that's working with groups outdoors. So like I say, if you go to carbonfarmers.world, you can pick up one of these stoves, and honestly, it will change your outdoor sessions for the best. Thank you so much to the guys at Forest Tawi for sponsoring this episode.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think that there are lots of different answers to it, lots of different kind of factors, and, you know, the kind of disavowal of the maternal, or of the experience of child raising is endemic, really, and, you know, from, like, feminist academia, even, like, is very, can be very kind of shunning of the maternal experience, and I just kind of bizarrely uninterested. I guess like one of the reasons would just be kind of really straight up common garden misogyny, and a kind of inherited sense. You know, in my research, I kind of look back to, you know, the old dudes like Plato and Aristotle, and, you know, like Herbert Spencer and Rousseau, you know, these guys who have created our like kind of Western cultural belief system, and you know, there's just such a strong sense through that of a kind of denial of the mother and a denial of pregnancy and childbirth, you know, to the point where I think it's Aristotle or maybe Aquinas, you know, writes things like, you may think it's the woman who gives birth, but actually, you know, it's actually that, you know, they had this idea that a man would deposit like within the woman's womb, like an actual kind of tiny man, basically, you know, drawing for like hilarious, a homunculus, it's called. Oh, like a fully formed. Yeah. You've got to look at the pictures, they're really funny. And then I guess, like, if we're thinking about it, like, in more contemporary time, I think one of the historical threads which I think makes quite a lot of sense of it is, you know, liberal feminism has done so much to emancipate women into the workplace. And, you know, yes, there's been lots of, like, issues with second wave feminism, etc., but it seems like liberal feminism came up at a time of, like, neoliberalism, like Thatcherism, Reaganism, and this kind of toxic individualistic idea of a person and a kind of economic situation, which meant women, the workplace, the market needed women to be working more. Certainly in my kind of feminist upbringing, it was all about like smashing the glass ceiling, like being a girl boss, mm-hmm. like you're very much focused on like the workplace and you know, being like a good neoliberal citizen. And I think in all that, motherhood just was kind of left in the cold. And I think it's Ali Hochschild who calls it the stalled revolution. And I guess, I don't know, there was something when I was writing this book, I was quite nervous about it because it felt like writing about motherhood, you know, was kind of unfashionable, or, you know, that by even writing about like what my body went through in pregnancy, birth and early motherhood, that I might be playing into kind of essentialist tropes, or, you know, the idea that women have always been limited by like their potential reproductive function, so we try and kind of pretend we're like men, or we try and be like men in the world and have to kind of pretend that all the other stuff doesn't happen. So I think it's like that's just a couple of things, but I think it's a really heady mix. I didn't really come across any other theories I can mention, but I think, you know, it's economics, it's culture, it's social society, and it's and it's also, and I'll end on this, I think it suits our, the kind of systems and structures of power to keep child rearing, child raising, pregnancy and birth in private, and kind of in the shadows and hidden, because then it doesn't have to be properly supported or properly you know, waged, or, you know, and so on. Yeah. So I think it, you know, it suits, you know, like for example with GDP, like care work and reproductive labour is not included in GDP. So GDP is actually like, it's like mythical. It's like a fiction, because you've got all this work, you know, creating like the workers and so on. So yeah, I think that's partly it. Sorry, a bit of a long rambly answer.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and just like so much there. I mean, we could spend the whole hour just talking about what you've kind of covered there. And obviously, you know, books like yours are helping to try to change that. And I feel like there are like tiny little shifts that happen, aren't there, in terms of like what you just said really reminded me of kind of increasing awareness of behind great men who have done great things. There's just like these women like doing all this unpaid work so that these men had the time and the energy and, you know, support to be able to go off and make their great discoveries or their great works of art. And I think there's definitely more talk about that, I think, in recent years.
I sent you a link, didn't I? I think when there was something I was seeing a while ago where it was, someone was saying they wanted a podcast where it was like a companion podcast to all of the very alpha, optimize your life men's podcast. And they wanted a podcast that was just all of those people's partners to go through their morning routines and their like daily things, so that you could have this, you know, to contrast the, I wake up at 4:01 and I jump in my ice bath and I, you know, digest my whatever it is, to have the other side of all of that stuff, you know, shown.
Yeah. That is so good. That would be brilliant. That would be so popular. You'll be like, I've been awake all night.
or just having the team of people. Yeah. You know, just one person going, this is my day. And then all of the supporting players in that, you know, stuff that goes on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like Greg Wallace's day in the life that went viral, you know, like a comeback from his wife, his mother-in-law, his PA, all those people. Yeah. This is my day in the life. And this is how I experience it.
Yeah. I think, I guess, though, there is a, I think, like, without wanting to get too, like, I don't know, philosophical or kind of wonky about it, I think there's also, there's something about, like, in our culture, like, a fear of dependence and a kind of fear of vulnerability and a kind of, you know, like, this idea of, like, self-reliance and self-sufficiency and like, the individual self being able to just make it in the world. And that story is like propped up by, you know, invisibilizing all those other people. And I think it also links to probably like, you know, your original question and like the disavowal and like denial of birth and so on. Like, I imagine that is partly a kind of, and there are theories of this, you know, a kind of denial of our dependency, like our original, you know, need for other people. Am I cussing out? Can you still hear me?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, no, cool. Yeah, I can still hear
You know, our original like vulnerability. Mm. And I mean, okay, I promise I'll end on this, but I think that idea has done so much harm to us, because I think you can see it in our social relationships, but also in how we, in the global north and kind of our Western cultures, relate to the earth as well. Mm-hmm. You know, a kind of like, you know, we're not connected, we're just machines, we can do what we want, we don't need anything, we're above it all. So I think it's all like interlinked.
Yeah, it's got to be like a sort of either a circle or a spiral in some direction. If you don't celebrate the thing, you don't encourage people to talk about the thing, so then they celebrate it less, so then they talk about it less, so then they set, you know, it's one of the things I was going to ask you actually was, through the book, you're talking about this like lack of ceremony around and like cultural rites of passage and things like that, and saying that, you know, we have some. And Wem made some very helpful notes here and said that, I can't remember the words. Oh, we were talking, it was gender showers and gender showers. That's what I'm going to, no, I'm going with gender showers.
Gender reveals.
It's gender showers and baby reveals. That those are not necessarily meeting the I was going to say the right need, but that's not maybe correct. Can you tell us a bit more about that, like, cultural celebration side of things?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I got interested in this idea because, so I give a bit of backstory. I read the word matrescence when my first child was about 9 months old. And briefly before that point, I had felt extremely shocked by becoming a mother, very bewildered, very obviously like sleep deprived, very, very happy to be a mother and very grateful for my beloved child, but very startled by the isolating nature of motherhood and how big it felt. And for a long time before I read the word matrescence, I kind of thought there was something really wrong with me, that I was being like, I was totally overreacting to this like ordinary thing that happens to most people. You know, I was diagnosed with postnatal depression. And then when I read the word matrescence, I was like my shoulders like dropped for the first time. So matrescence, for anyone who's listening who doesn't know the word, means quite simply the process of becoming a mother. And in this piece I read in the New York Times, it described how in in the process of becoming a mother, of course, there's great joy, but there's also fear and anger and all these different emotions because it's a big deal. So I went back to the original text where the word matrescence was first used, which was by an anthropologist called Dana Raphael, and it was an essay from 1974. So as I said, she was an anthropologist, so she was coming at it from writing about and explaining how other cultures in the world have this sense of matrescence. And she wrote that in most cultures and societies in the world, becoming a mother is seen as a kind of big life crisis, like not crisis in like a midlife crisis, but in like the original Greek sense of like a huge change. And that most cultures have rites, rituals, celebrations, ways of honouring, acknowledging the newborn mother. And, you know, that could be like a period where the new mother is looked after so she can look after the baby, ceremonies to give thanks for, you know, her safe passage through childbirth, different massages, plants, you know, herbs. There's a lot of different ways people do this, but in our culture, certainly, you know, in the global north, and I was coming into motherhood in my kind of white middle class Judeo-Christian culture. The norm is, you know, you have a baby and you're probably in hospital for a night, and then you're at home and your partner probably has to go back to work after 2 weeks, and that, you know, then you get on with it. So you struggle to get on with it and write a book about it. So I think, yeah, I felt like a kind of like yearning or a longing for rites and rituals. And I found some in some ways, and you know, in the end, and actually one of the really big ones for me has been like going to forest school with my toddler and like attending a forest school with older women, older mothers, different people. And that has been a really nice ritual for me. But yeah, and I think, I guess like people do things like mother blessings now. Like, I mean, I think there should be a ritual for dads as well, like a patrescence ritual. There used to be one in the Christian church called churching, which I write a bit about in the book.
Yeah.
So I think there are, I was talking to the chief druid recently, or the old chief druid, and they were saying they were talking about maybe a druid way of honouring matrescence. But I think that we need something.
Mate, a thousand, yeah. Sorry, we need
it's
to acknowledge
all about the baby,
how,
isn't it?
How smooth the sentence
chief druid.
I was chatting to the chief druid the other day. That just didn't even clock it, just went, oh, just put that there. There you go. That was incredible.
Well,
I assumed
you guys might like know the druids.
Not personally. I wish I did.
Well, you should, they're really cool.
I just watched that Ben Edge documentary about folk Britain. Yeah. Have you seen that? Frontline Folk. They're in there. They're in there quite heavily. Walking around London in their white robes on May Day, you know, amongst the traffic.
I should watch that. I went to their winter gathering I spoke at their winter gathering, and there was a lot of forest school overlap, actually. There was a lot of people there. Mm. But it was amazing. It was so many people. And I just liked lots of stuff about animism. And
yeah.
Yeah, it was cool.
Sorry, Wem, you were midway through a question and I trampled all over it.
I can't remember what it was now.
Have you guys found any rituals or rites around parenthood? Or
have you read Rituals for Life by Ina MacLeod?
I would
or
like
seen any
to.
Of her work?
I would really like to. Actually, yeah. I think she was at the Druid Winter Gathering.
Yeah.
She's awesome. And yes, oh my gosh. This is, I happen to have it so here. I didn't
Isla's
even
been on the
plan
podcast.
That. And
we've,
there
we've
is,
chatted with her.
She has been on the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
There are lots of different suggestions for rituals in here. And one of them is about celebrating women. I can't remember if it's specifically about motherhood. I think it probably is. But yeah, there is an idea in there, which does, I think, draw from different cultures around the world as well, like some ideas for kind of using like clay paint and things like that.
Nice.
And yeah, I'm flicking through, but I can't find it exactly. But yes, that's the only place I've really come across anything like that at all, you know. And that's quite recently written and quite new to me, that kind of idea.
I've started making matrescence greetings cards. Like, I just like make, because you know, you can't really buy a card for like the mum. So I make like matrescence love cards. I sell them on my website.
Oh, that's lovely.
Something like that, like to honour and acknowledge and mark.
Yeah. And you want something that is, we've talked about ritual quite a lot on the podcast in terms of marking moments, because it feels like there's a lack of that in our culture, as we've been talking about, and a real need for it. But at the same time, like not absolutely scaring everyone shitless. Because if you suddenly, like I was thinking about you saying about forest school feeling like a real ritual for you with your children. And, you know, we run two different toddler groups. And so lots of people go through pregnancy whilst visiting forest school every week, and so we go on that journey sort of with them. And then lots of people bring their babies when they're so new, and they really, it's so special, like everyone just gets so excited, the mums are really excited, and the babies are all like tiny and all squished up in the sling. And last time it happened, two came on the same day, the mothers were pregnant through at the same time, weren't they? And and it did feel like that was a thing that kind of was just there waiting to be acknowledged. And I kind of acknowledged it by squealing quite a lot and getting overexcited. But at the same time, you don't want to go, and now lay your babies down and we shall, you know, garland you with the things. And they go, oh my God, what's going on? And like already there have been mutterings about, you know, the fact that we run a weird cult school in the woods. So, you know, you don't, you want it to be inclusive in that way, don't you? And it's so difficult for us to kind of, if you're already moving in those circles, it's fine. If you're, it's not like a massive hurdle to go, okay, yeah, I'm doing this ritual, it's fine, I'm used to it. But if you're, and especially if you're in a community where you, where it's a mixture of some people who are on that train already and some people who aren't, it's so tricky, isn't it?
I think you're right. I mean, maybe rituals and rites in our kind of secularized culture look really different to like what we think of when we think of rituals, you know, like maybe it's things like parent and baby groups, or handing down clothes, or things like that, you know. Cooking a meal, like dropping a meal around, or but I think anything that looks after the parent and the mother and as well is just, we just need a bit more of that.
Yeah, because that's the thing, isn't it? It's all about the baby. It's like, even when the baby is so little, those, you know, you describe quite a lot in the book about, you know, checkups are for the baby. And then it's just like, oh, yeah, let's have a look at mum for 2 minutes. Anyway, you're probably fine anyway. Back to the baby. And that's the kind of sort of medical and looking after-y type stuff is for the baby. And then even parent and baby groups that you might go to, I felt, and I think every mother I knew felt the same way, that you go for the baby. And the fact that there are other new mothers there might be an added like bonus, maybe, but you go because like baby yoga is really good for your baby, or baby sensory is really good for your baby. And if you don't do that, then you're not giving them the best start in life. It is all about them.
Totally. And I think then it's no wonder you get women saying, I have to basically sacrifice myself, you know, and like annihilate myself in the service of my children, or you know, in this like mode of mothering, which is, you know, the culturally acceptable one in our society. You know, it's like no wonder it's like this kind of drip, drip, drip of, you know, you don't count. Of course, baby counts massively, but there's two people, there's three people usually. There should be more. There should be more. Like, I've never looked up communes more in my life. Where can I move to a commune? They always end badly though, which is not.
You do write about sort of that section of society at large, and you do mention a couple of projects, I think, that you sort of say are doing a really great job at supporting mothers, as opposed to just babies, or you know, mothers come second, and you describe a couple of projects like that. Have you come across many sort of support networks or things that you think do work and are breaking the mold a little bit in terms of places where mothers can feel supported?
Today's episode of the Forest School Podcast is brought to you by us, Children of the Forest. Me and Wen wanted to let you know about our Level 3 Forest School Leader training course. We are down in Devon. Well, we're on the Devon-Somerset border. We're right off the M5. So anybody that's travelling up and down that motorway, we are super easy to get to. Our training is 10 days, not 5 like some people do. 10 immersive days in our woods, surrounded by all our like amazing play structures and resources. And we deep dive over those 10 days into not just what's covered in the course, but also we do things like play theory, neurodiversity, holistic human needs to make sure that you're equipped to facilitate the best possible forest school experiences. We keep you on track with monthly online meetings, email support. We have a Discord server for all our students, helping you to navigate the coursework, and we provide regular feedback. It's not one of those like you've done it and now you're out on your own. You have to rely on Facebook groups or people who've done the course before. Like you, we meet you all the way through the course, and our flexible submission options mean we can work around your learning style, including submitting some of your coursework as video discussions or as different things. We've had people submit watercolor paintings as part of their coursework, and that's absolutely fine, all counts. So whenever possible, we also visit your site and come and observe your sessions, not in an assessment kind of way, but in a like free consultancy that's built into the course. We come and look and like, hey, I wonder if you could design this thing over here, or maybe your staff look like they could do with some training in X, Y, Z. We're there to kind of give you that extra bump up. So don't miss this opportunity to transform your career, make a lasting impact in children's lives. You can visit childrenoftheforest.com, and there's hyphens in between all those words, or you can email us at childrenoftheforest@outlook.com to learn more about our Forest School Leader training course. Please, please, please don't wait around on this one, guys. We only do one course a year, and we only have about 15 spaces so that we can give the right amount of attention to people. And next one starts in autumn of this year. So again, head to childrenoftheforest.com and get yourself or somebody else you know booked on to that course today.
Yeah, I think there's definitely like a movement happening, or I mean, it might be just that I'm like clued into it now since publishing the book, but it feels like there is like a real energy and momentum around like the idea of concept of matrescence. And there's a lot of like matrescence kind of coaches or circles or ways of kind of gathering women together. I think there's some really brilliant organisations out there, people like Pandas or Maternal Mental Health Alliance, Mothers Uncovered, Pregnant and Screwed. There's, you know, Mother Pucker. There's a lot of people doing really great work. And I think I'm seeing more kind of grassroots groups where kind of mothers are a bit more central, maybe. But I think part of the, you know, we need systems change, and we need like a lot of infrastructure to be different, and, you know, big structural evolutions. But in the meantime, like my sense from, you know, interviewing and talking to mums around the book and having correspondence with people since it was published, is that there's like so much shame and stigma around just like being honest about what it can be like to become a parent, and how hard it can be, how wonderful it can be. I think there's like so many different taboos in different ways, both around the joys and the challenges. Mm. And I think there is like real power in people gathering, and it's definitely something that I've noticed in the events that I've done and the Q&As afterwards. I normally don't really like Q&As because I don't really like being put on the spot. But they've been a bit like consciousness raising groups and like, you know, people sharing ideas and sharing their stories. Like I love that you've read the book, Lewis, and I always like absolutely, I love it when I hear that men have read it and like dads are reading it. And so I think it is, I mean, it's not on me to say who should read my book at all. Like, it's not mine anymore. It's out there. But I think that, you know, dads, partners, everyone needs to be part of the solution as well. You know?
Yeah.
It's going to help everyone. If we can make it better.
I feel like I'm really sat on the fence because I am personally desperate to ask you questions about how they relate to like my experience and things that I can do, but I'm really hyper aware that like this is a book about how like mums don't get enough attention, and I potentially am about to like ask a lot of questions of like, hey, as a man, tell me about the man things and what men should do, which is not the vibe I want to give off at all. It's really interesting, not just reading the book and reflecting on how the book impacts me, but all of the other stuff like around the book. So like when we read the book first, and I think when you were about halfway through and you were telling me bits of it, and I reflected that I felt, and I can't remember if I asked you if I should read it or if I could read it, but there was definitely like a word in there that was like, am I allowed to read this book? Is it for me? And that's interesting just to reflect that the book existed. You were telling me it was good. I wanted to read it, but I still felt like I needed someone to say, you can read this book. It's okay. It will be okay for you. And then one of the big things, it relates to a bit like what Wen was saying earlier about like, you don't want to completely over woo woo people with like, here's this crazy ceremony and doing whatever. I think as someone, so there's a lot of men who work in forest school and who work in early years. I would say probably of the early years sector, a lot more of the male profession in early years is through the forest school avenue. That's where a lot of us kind of exist. And I have this thing like beforehand, but even more so after reading Matrescence, that I'm like, oh, I really want to do a thing. I want to be supportive of this. I want to. And so there are things that I can do. Like we've, you know, recently renamed some of our toddler groups so that they're not so heavily advertising like that it's about the child. And when we go there, I like have these conversations. But there is a point where I can feel like birth stories come up a lot, obviously, in your book. And I can feel when people at toddler groups want to talk birth stories or maybe want to talk physicality, and I feel like I not have to leave, but in order, the way I facilitate the conversation is that I leave and give a space to that, because I can feel that there's something that's like, I've waffled myself into a corner that I'm not sure I can get out of with a question. You know, would you have advice for male people who are listening to this podcast who want to be supportive in these spaces, but who perhaps feel like that's not for me, or I mustn't intrude, or any of those kind of stereotypes?
Sure. And that's so, it sounds like what you do is so awesome and like just epic that you're kind of facilitating in that way and giving people a space for that. And yeah, I can totally see how, you know, like the physicality stuff. I think probably this book has been less read by my like male friends or male members of family, and I think that's probably because they're worried about reading like the birth stuff or maybe the graphic stuff perhaps. But I kind of, and I can see how that would be the case for kind of close, well, my dad's read it, but close friends. But I also felt that I wanted to write the book in a way that it would be doing justice to like like the drama of birth and how, you know, yeah, okay, it's a little bit, you know, brutal at times, but it's pretty like we've all been born in this way, and like none of us, like many of us, don't really know what it can, how, what it's like to be, you know, and I kind of feel like it would be good if more people knew, more men knew what it took for their mothers to bring them into the world, however they were born. Anyway, I'm not very good at giving advice, but I think I guess, you know, and I feel a bit uncomfortable kind of blowing my own trumpet in some way, but I do think that, like, some of the messages that I've got from people, I can't really talk directly about advice for people working for a school, but hopefully this will be helpful. You know, I've had quite a few really moving messages from people whose husbands have read Matrescence, and just learning about, like, the concept of Matrescence, which isn't mine. It was, you know, it was coined in the 70s, and plenty of people have written about it, has been, I think, really helpful even after the fact to try and kind of like understand a bit of, you know, if your partner is pregnant and gives birth and feeding your baby, like how that can impact on the body and the mind, and that you know, everyone's different obviously, but it can be a period of like vulnerability and you know, I feel like the disavowal of Matrescence does like no one any favors, because I mean I hear so, you know, there's so much about, like, you know, relationship difficulties as well, and you know, those early years, and actually, like, we know now that in putrescence, like, men's brains change, and you know, from hands-on affectionate caregiving, you know, you don't have to be, obviously you don't have to be pregnant and give birth to be a parent, and we know now that, like, brains completely change shape just from looking after children, and so yeah, I don't really know if I'm answering your question. I guess maybe just the I think the thing at the power of, like, the word matrescence and possibly putrescence is it gives a way of kind of acknowledging that this thing is happening or happened, and you know, you can even say, like, how's your matrescence, or you know, like, to make it, like, just normal to be able to talk about it, and it just gives us language and like a lexicon to support each other and chat, or even, like, you know, it's someone who's, yeah, you know, how was your matrescence? I've been really struck by people who've written to me, you know, they've had their children years ago, even decades ago, but, you know, that experience of becoming a parent was really formative, really can be really traumatic. People can be, you know, it's like adolescence. It's like a big wet part of your life journey. So yeah, maybe that's,
That is helpful. Thank you.
And also, I think there's a lot of our, when we were both reading it, it had prompted a lot of conversations with parents at our toddler groups, right, Liz? Do you remember? So it was a couple of months ago now. So one or other of us would be like, something happens in the toddler group, or someone says something and it goes, oh, have you read this book? You've just reminded me about this book, you know? And so then just talking about the book has opened up kind of conversations, and lots of people have started to open up about things about matrescence. And you're not the only man there either, Lewis. Like, our toddler groups are getting more and more. There are still more mothers present and grandmothers than there are male caregivers, but the number of male caregivers has increased every year, I'd say, in the sort of 7 or 8 years since we've been doing it. And so lots of people, I think, through creating that sense of community and just being in that place where we can talk about any book that we've read and we're around the fire and it feels safe, means that people feel that they can talk about it. And I don't think any of the women who were talking about it were kind of shying. I think there was a bit of laughter and a bit of like, oh, sorry. I would say over the nearly decade I've been doing this,
I have observed
this. Of course, you know. Of course. And what you say is valid, and that's how you feel as a man as well. But I'm just kind of saying, like, the fact that you can be there as a man alongside other male caregivers in a space where people feel comfortable talking about it, and yeah, like do a bit of a vibe check and be like, oh, maybe I need to step over this way now and make the tea or look after the kids. That's another thing that we try to do in our toddler group sometimes is to go, okay, well, these people feel like they need a bit of their own time to make something with their hands or just to sit and chill. We'll try and scoop up the children that are happy to go a little bit further away and do something so that we can allow that space.
So nice. But yeah. So nice. Like, so lush. I think I've only experienced that actually in forest school, of like the forest school leaders kind of feeling comfortable to kind of, you know, try and care for my child so I could, you know, like kind of sharing it. And that it's amazing. Yeah. It just makes it just feel so much easier that it's just like not all on you and that everyone's kind of looking out for each other's kids. And yeah, it's huge.
Yeah. And I think I don't know how you would feel about this, Lucy, but I feel like we are still year on year learning more and more about, like, oh, we can accommodate, not necessarily just in a matrescence sense, but like accommodating people, all the people that come, more and more in every, you know, going, oh, that would be a thing that would really help people out. Oh, that would be a thing that would really help people out. I wondered, so the your book sort of focuses on the immediacy of like pregnancy and childbirth and new motherhood. I'm using new because what I was going to ask was like, do you see matrescence as a, my mum always used to say to me, and this was a fantastic get out clause of any time she was, you should go, because I'm the oldest child, she would just go, I've never had a 14-year-old before. I've never had a 16-year-old before. It's really bloody hard to argue with that kind of logic. Like, just really, like, it's really good. Like, hats off to my mum. But, like,
I'm going to steal that.
Yeah, it's really good. But I was wondering about, like, what your views on a matrescence as a, not necessarily as just something that stops at, like, primary age children or even like adulthood, you know, like is matrescence something in your mind that carries on into like, what's it like to have a 30-year-old child? What's it like to have a, you know,
60-year-old child? Yeah. I mean, I imagine so. Like, I think some people say matrescence never ends. I mean, I can see how that would be the case. My eldest is 7 and a half. And while I think there's probably something about like the like physical, biological kind of seismic changes of the first couple of years being like really quite, you know, dramatic and everything changing. Like, well, my experience is that, like, you know, and it's such a cliche, but every stage is different, and that means every, you know, parenting is different, and you're yes, this is my 4-year-old.
Can't sleep.
I'll come and say goodnight to you in a minute, sweetheart.
Can you come and live, mate?
I'll come in a minute, my darling. Okay. And through that, like some of the stuff I write about in matrescence and has been like present for me is, I'm sure it's for so many people, like, you know, reflecting on yourself at that age and it bringing up stuff at that age. And, you know, I imagine that, like, I had quite a tumultuous adolescence. I imagine that when my kids, I mean, most of us did, didn't we? I imagine when my daughter is 14, I can imagine that for me in my ongoing matrescence could be quite an intense moment. So, yeah, I mean, I think that it's really interesting what we're learning about, like, the neuroscience around parenting and how, like, it's all so new, all this stuff about how, like, when people become parents, their brains really change in multiple areas. And, like, even in the last kind of year or two, a study showed that the brain changes last for 6 years, but then another study suggests they kind of last forever. I mean, I don't know, you guys might have older children than me, but I think that I imagine that, like, I think that, like, the nervous system must be affected differently at different times. Like, for me right now, I've got a 7-year-old, 4-year-old, and a 3-year-old. And it's incredibly physical. Like, you know, I'm hugged, like, all day and all night. You know, I'm constantly in, like, a physical relation with my young children. And, you know, I think there's, you know, that can sometimes be quite overwhelming, but it's also very kind of, on an animal, mammal level, you know, quite rewarding. And I imagine that when, you know, that will have to shift when, you know, they're older and they don't want to hug me all the time, and then my nervous system might, you know, that, you know, I think it's so complicated being a human, isn't it? And
well,
yeah, I'm at that stage where I have to ask my children for a hug now. I asked my son earlier, he's nearly 12, and I had to just go, I just saw him and I just had this, like, overwhelming urge to just, like, squeeze him. And so I had to go, do you mind if I, like, squeeze you and lift you up? And he went, oh, fine. I had to, like, squeeze him, like, spin him round a few times, you know, because, yeah, it absolutely, I think, goes the other way, that you're like, I just crave this, like, physical closeness, but I have to really respect that you might not want that.
You just get a really big teddy or, like, a dog or something.
Yeah. And maybe glue a photo of my kid's face.
Oh, my God, I would so be that. There's a market for that, probably.
Oh, my God.
Lucy, I was going to ask, you just said then it's so complicated being human. All of the chapters in the Matrescence book have these little, like, animal sections in them. That's like, that didn't need to be in there. And I don't mean that in the way of, like, I didn't like it didn't need to be in there. Like, I love it. It's great. But what was the thinking behind putting these little animal matrescence and putrescence facts into the book?
Yeah. So I kind of call them, like, ecological vignettes. That sounds really pretentious. But so the book is cut through with these stories of tadpoles, volcanoes, sea squirts, bats, slime molds. That's the prologue. So there was a number of reasons I wanted to do that. One was kind of going back to, like, our original, you know, the first question. Like, I couldn't find my experience anywhere in what I was reading. So everything I was reading was, like, bounce back, like, nothing about how, like, a mother would change, or, you know, your body changes, everything changes. And I am someone who wants to be outdoors all the time, and I'm in the woods as much as I can be, or in my garden. And I found myself drawn in a really urgent way to metamorphosis in the natural world. So when I felt like the human world was just, like baffling me, if I went to the woods and I just spent time with slime molds, so if anyone who doesn't, I'm sure everyone who listens knows about slime molds, but, like, slime molds have this extraordinary metamorphosis where they have loads of different life cycles. Sorry, it wouldn't be an interview with me if I didn't, like, wang on about slime molds.
So
in their plasmodium stage, they're like this yellow, you will have seen it, yellow slick, and it moves around and it's like an animal, and it predates, it can learn, it can anticipate, it can teach. And then at some point it transforms, like, dramatically into a completely different organism, like sessile, spore releasing. They look like teeny tiny mushrooms, they're not fungi, they're in the Protista kingdom. If you've never seen them, what they look like, you need to look up Barry Webb's photographs on Instagram. Mm. They're really brightly coloured, they're really intricate, they're incredibly beautiful, and they're everywhere. anyway, I found myself so drawn to organisms that go through a metamorphosis, and it really grounded me and it helped me to feel normal and to know that change and process is like the most natural thing. And it just made me feel sane. And then at the same time, I also found that I was quite always loved like the natural world, but I got quite, I've always been quite but scientific as well, like quite into science and data and stuff. But I got very like drawn into ideas of like natural birth, natural parenting, being a natural mother, you know, all this stuff. And for me, my experience was that like birth was pretty traumatic. I couldn't exclusively breastfeed because of physical reason. I got postnatal depression. I couldn't soothe my colicky baby. You know, it basically like upended everything that I felt I was being told about like natural mother. And instead, what I found, you know, where I found solace was in thinking about actually the violence of nature and the brutality of nature. Like birth for me was like incredibly violent, and like thinking about volcanoes and you know, the moon being formed from a collision, I just found that quite relaxing. I mean, it sounds, probably sounds really weird. Or even like sometimes days when I had my second child and, you know, I was looking after two really little ones, I would often feel totally devoured by the demands on me. And, you know, when I read about spiders eating their own mothers, a process called matrophagy, you know, I just like stuff like that. It kind of, you know, it kind of upended all this quite oppressive, like limiting association of like nature with womanhood. Like I just wanted to make it a bit more gothic and make it a bit more punk and kind of, you know, like that's what nature is. It is all that stuff, as well as being one, you know, lovely and pretty and wonderful. So I cut the book like that. And then the third, sorry, it's a long answer, but the other reason I wanted to have the ecological thread running through was because it was such an ecological experience for me becoming a mother. Like I really realised that I was an animal, and I was a mammal, and that I metamorphosed, like, you know, everything else. And, you know, it really brought me quite close to kind of like closer to like the sap and the soil and death, like birth, all that stuff, you know, kind of mortality, you know, very existential. So yeah, that felt like an important thread, even though, like you say, it's a bit random. But interesting, that's the kind of, that's the thing that people have really responded to. And I've kind of developed the thinking a bit. I'm calling it macro ecology. So a way of using kind of like, like the maternal as a thinking apparatus to kind of think about ecology, and ecology to think about the maternal. And when I say the maternal, I don't mean it in a kind of exclusive way. I mean that to mean any caregiving, any, you know, child raising, even like, you know, caregiving to non-human kin and anything like that. So, and a really open and wide definition for everyone.
That's definitely something I found, is like for all of those, like sometimes it's difficult to get into those types of topics and stuff, but people are often very comfortable because sometimes I like to eat info dump about stuff that you know about nature. We all do. It's great. But when you can, if you can info dump a bit about like an animal's matrescence or an animal's like reproductive cycle, that lands in such a different way. Because I was, one of the things that's been floating around my head is this thing of like, you know, we've said a few times, like forest schools are this great places where you can have these conversations and you can feel this kind of like we're all valued, you know, the adults are just as valued as the children, but there is always something I think that is like, particularly with the more like physical side of matrescence, where I think some people have this feeling of like, I'd rather not do this in a room, in an area full of 3 to 5 year olds, because I'm going to be describing something that's just not something I want to share. But that you can have very similar conversations, and sometimes with adults, I will use it as like a very thick metaphor, you know, where you go like, we know what we're talking about, but I'm actually going to talk to you about like blackbirds, and like mummy blackbird has to really make sure she's got enough food at the moment, because she's going to have to sit and look after the babies all day, and so that's really important. And you can have that conversation in a much more open, and I mean that in terms of like if someone was to overhear, or it feels like it needs to be less private than a direct human to human conversation.
And there's less like moral stuff associated with the natural world, isn't there? So all that stuff you were saying about, you know, being attracted to like natural motherhood and natural birth and stuff, and you talk about that in the book about like extreme medicalization on one hand, and then like really pressured kind of natural approach on the other side, and lots of us get kind of stuck in between those two things, or one way or the other, and not feeling comfortable in either place, because there's almost like that assumption of like, oh, if you're going to be natural, you should, like that word should comes up all the time, like, and you know, I remember being told like, oh, well, your body should only grow the size of baby that you're able to birth. So don't worry about the fact that your baby is flipping enormous. And the stenographer has been like, it's a really big baby. It's really big, really big. It's a really big baby, you know. And my like pregnancy yoga teacher is just like, don't worry, because your body just will. Your body knows. And then, yeah. And then you think, oh, sorry, that's my cat looking candle for side. God damn it. No, that was actually my cat. Cross species adoption has resulted in me having a cat that smashes stuff. Yeah. And so, stop it, cat. Yeah. So then, obviously, as you say, nature is really violent. Stuff dies. Like, babies starve, mothers die, like bad stuff happens, and there's no like moral attachment to that. There's no like, oh well, they should have done the right thing, and they should have like chilled out more so that they had a better birth. They should have done some hypnotherapy and then it would have been fine. Stupid, it's their own fault. You know, no one does that with nature. And so, as you say, to kind of see that link there, give, you know, you said yourself about it, like, just makes you go, oh, phew.
Yeah.
Like,
that is such a good point. Yeah, you put that so well. I think the moral, yeah, I hadn't quite until you said that. Like, that is, I think that's so, that it makes a lot of sense. It's almost like, I kind of feel increasingly at the moment, like, our language, our storytelling, our myths, our ideas, our ways of thinking are just, like, very inadequate right now. And like, yeah, full of morality and shoulds, or and there's something about kind of thinking through nature, or macho ecological thinking, as I call it, which I think can really like free you up a bit and kind of break down some of those kind of stagnant, you know, things like, yeah.
Come on, pull it back, because we can't finish a podcast on life is death and volcanoes at the end. I can't. No. We have to find some way to pull this back.
I feel like there's something about, you know, I always think that economics is such a big part of everything, and I feel like, you know, our world is so directed by things like profit and growth, and but in like little pockets of resistance, like places like Forest School, or you know, collective groups and like gatherings of people, even online. You know, I think there's a lot of like good kind of digital connecting. You know, if we can think through stories of kind of care and through other, you know, what can the earth teach us? Like being like students of the earth or the woods, and you know, what can the slime molds teach us? And you know, if we look again, like more, you know, at the earth that we live on and the, you know, the beings around us and the forces that we are in, rather than, you know, this kind of, like, it, again, it's like a disavowal of the earth, or, you know, like there's so many, yeah, we do mow a little patch of our lawn, but today there were so many lawnmowers going, and like, you know, it's just, so it's a bit of a random tangent, but I don't know. I feel like we can really think better through the earth and through care, like, and through thinking about care. It's like time, isn't it?
Yeah.
To do that. I mean, you guys are already doing it in your work, and lots of people are.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's hard when it doesn't pay, isn't it? That's going back to that, like, economic thing. It's like, yeah, should be better. The people who care the most often get the least money to make their lives comfortable to do that. It's hard. What are you doing next, Lucy? Have you got like a new project on the horizon, or are you still very much in a process of sort of talking about Matrescence and going on tour and things like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I'm still talking in Matrescence quite a lot. So it comes out in paperback in June, and it's out in like the States and a few other countries. So, I mean, I am mostly like look after my kids, and then I am interested in some other subjects. I'm really interested in like sugar and emotional regulation. That's something I'm interested in. Maybe writing a novel about all the stuff about motherhood I couldn't write in the memoir.
Oh, nice.
But, you know, it is caregiving is like the main thing at the moment. Might train to be a forest school leader.
Do it.
Oh, come to Devon. Do it with us. Start in late September. Yeah. See you then.
Where in Devon?
In the middle of Devon, near Columpton, just off the M5.
Yeah, okay. Maybe it's Mondays. Meant to be. I just want to be in the woods all the time. I've got to work out a way of doing that.
I think we all must go to our child caring duties.
Yes.
We probably do.
Thank you very much, Lucy, for spending the time with us.
Thank you
for the book. It's incredible.
Oh no, I'm so glad that to be here and that it spoke to you, and yeah, it's really lovely to have this conversation. I've learnt a lot, and I think we'll do it again.
Okay. Yay. Cheers then, mate.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye. See you in the woods.
Bye.
It's time to thank the Patreon people, but I'm going to thank them in a slightly different lens this time. Normally, we thank you lovely, lovely people that are supporting us on Patreon from behalf of me and Wem. But you guys on Patreon are the ones who have supported this episode. You have brought this episode to all the people listening. So there are people listening to this episode who got to listen to a podcast because of the generosity of these lovely Patreon people. If you want to be somebody who is generous enough to support this podcast and to help give it to more people, then you can head to patreon.com/theforestschoolpodcast. But this episode with Lucy Jones was brought to you by Rachel and Karen, Matthew, Catherine, Gareth, Rebecca, Rosie, Julie, Rachel, Candice, Claire, Heidi, Louise, Michael, and Anna. So on behalf of everybody that's listening to this podcast, I would like to say thank you to all you people for making this podcast possible. And if you want to sign up, you can go to patreon.com/theforestschoolpodcast.